Thank you all for coming. Welcome to this LSE Literary Festival event on, check the title here, Was Brexit a Populist Revolution? I'm Simon Hicks. I'm the Harold Lasky Professor of Political Science in the Department of Government here at the LSE. This event is organised by Department of Government. We have a hashtag for the event, I think, up here somewhere. Is it LSE? What has she given me as a hashtag here? LSC LitFest hashtag, that's for all the LitFest events. And we have three excellent speakers. I'm going to ask James to speak first. James Tilley is Professor of Politics and Fellow at Jesus College, Oxford. He's one of the UK's leading political scientists of public opinion and electoral behaviour, and has just published with his Oxford colleague Jeff Evans a new book called The New Politics of Class, The Political Exclusion of the British Working Class. James will be signing copies of the book in the lobby after the event, if you're interested. Then we have Mary Jaszewski, on my furthest left here, is a writer and broadcaster and a leading commentator on international affairs. She's a former Moscow correspondent for The Times. She writes a weekly column in The Independent and is a regular contributor to many other publications in the UK and internationally. And to my immediate left here, we have Rhiannon Lucy Coslett. She is a freelance writer, a regular contributor to The Guardian, and in my view, is the leading feminist commentator in British politics today. She's co-founded the Vigenda blog and is co-author with Holly Baxter of the Vigenda, A Zero Tolerance Guide to the Media. So, James, I've asked to go first. Each of the speakers is going to talk for about 5 minutes. I'll maybe follow up with a question or two, and then we'll open it up to Q&A to the audience. James, was Brexit a populist revolution?
Well, I think I'm going to conclude that probably it wasn't, but Simon asked me earlier, you know, was this a kind of class revolt? So I'm going to start with that and then come to the idea of populism a bit later. So if you look at the characteristics that differentiate people that voted Leave or voted Remain, then they are indeed based on kind of deep-rooted economic differences between people. There's lots of different ways to think about social class, but I'll talk mainly about occupational class and education. So occupational class is basically a way of measuring people's economic situation. It's related to their income, but it captures some extra stuff as well. Now, people that voted to Remain were more middle class, richer, and they were much more likely to have a degree than people that voted to Leave. So if I take a group of people who have a degree, have a professional kind of middle class job, about a third of them voted to Leave. Take a group of people who have a working class job, few qualifications, about three quarters of them voted to Leave. That's a big difference in social science terms. You don't normally see these kind of social characteristics predicting attitudes quite so well. And indeed, a lot of the regional variation that we saw across council areas, at least in England and Wales, is almost entirely explained by the percentage of people in the different areas that have a degree or have a working class job. Once you account for that, there's pretty much no regional variation within England and Wales, at least. So why is there this great class divide, or why was there? Didn't class politics die a death 20 years ago with Tony Blair? Well, essentially, the reason for this is because class and education shaped the key attitudes that affected people's choice in the referendum. Those attitudes are attitudes towards the economic benefits of the EU, attitudes towards immigration, and attitudes towards national sovereignty. Now, obviously, other things affect those attitudes, but class is a really strong determinant of them, and it works in the same way in all three. So it's reinforcing itself each time. And there's some good reasons for why we might expect those kind of differences to exist. On average, the people that tend to economically benefit from EU membership are more middle-class people. People with lots of education and professional jobs, they're the ones that tend to benefit from EU market integration. People in working-class jobs with lower levels of education tend to lose out. Same kind of thing with immigration. Immigration overall has basically got a zero effect on the economy, but within that there's winners and there's losers, and the losers tend to be low-skilled workers since most immigration is low-skilled. Now, that's a straightforward part of the story, but it's not the only part, and maybe not even the most important part, because it's not just about brute economic forces. There's other stuff going on as well. More middle-class people tend to have a weaker sense of national identity in particular, and that's a crucial component of what causes people to vary their attitudes on those three things that I mentioned. So more middle-class people have a weaker sense of national identity, they're less rooted in local communities, especially in cities, they're more likely to have lived and worked abroad, and so on. And that means that middle-class people with degrees tend to be less bothered about cultural change due to immigration, less bothered about foreign institutions essentially taking power away from British institutions. Now, that's all a matter of degree. It's not like there's millions of middle-class people in Britain that are, think of themselves as European. Obviously, there aren't. But that sense of Britishness, and particularly Englishness, is much weaker amongst the middle classes than it is amongst the working class. And so that inevitably means the idea of Europe is more popular amongst middle-class people. So class and education matter because they affect both who benefits from the EU, but also who likes this idea of a European identity and European political institutions. And all those things become reinforced because of the way in which class affects people's everyday lives, because I'm going to typically hang around with people like me, people who have a similar level of education and do similar kinds of jobs. And that means that those class views become the norm for my group of peers, and therefore I'm more likely to adopt those views. All of that together is a recipe for big class differences. So, to go back to the original question, though, was it a kind of working class revolution in some way? Well, I would say no. And the reason I'd say no is because almost all the things I've said so far were true 30 years ago. The difference between social classes and support for the EU is incredibly long-standing. It's been around pretty much since Britain joined. Now, the link between immigration and the EU, that's a product of the last decade or so, but there's actually just as big differences in support for the EU in the 1980s between the classes as there was last year at the referendum. What happened was those differences were disguised by party politics to a large extent. So when people vote for a party, they pick that party for lots of different reasons. Some of them to do with the policies, some of them to do with the competence of the, or perceived competence of the party, some perhaps to do with the leaders, all sorts of things. But the referendum's an opportunity for people to express their preferences on one single policy issue. Not a large set of issues that are bundled together alongside judgments of competence and judgments about leaders. So when that happens, those class differences are going to seem a lot larger because we've seen it exhibited in a behaviour when people went out and voted. But those divisions were still always there to pretty much the same degree. They were just disguised by the day-to-day operation of parties. So I don't think I'd really describe it as a revolution. A populist revolution? Probably not either. I think populism is a vague term. It can include a lot of different things, but certainly the way I would define it is a kind of anti-elite, anti-establishment, and maybe ideology is a bit strong, but at least view of the world. So populist politicians are ones that make, you know, claims to represent the people against out-of-touch elites, that kind of thing. But it really wasn't that kind of anti-elite feeling was the main driver of how people actually voted. There's really tiny differences in vote choice between, say, people who trust politicians and people who don't trust politicians once we account for those three key attitudes that I mentioned earlier. So in the end, and I don't know if this is a good or bad start to the discussion, but I guess I would conclude that really it was neither a revolution nor is it populist. Rather, direct democracy meant that this long-standing difference between social classes actually just became more visible to people.
So a working-class revolt, at least, then?
Well.
Mary, what do you mean?
Hello, thank you very much for inviting me, and I hope maybe I'll have some interesting arguments to make against the ones we've just heard. In some ways, I'm going to scrap what I actually prepared to say because I think it's much more interesting to answer the specific points that you've just heard. One of these was that this was, as your payoff line, it was neither populist nor a revolution. And I think probably on balance it was actually both. The biggest point, I think, where we diverge is that we've heard the sort of figures and the breakdown and the sophology about it, and how it was largely people with a higher education against people without a higher education, and that the actual issue on the table, as on the ballot paper, was the question of membership of the European Union. But I think I would argue that people actually, by and large, were not voting on the issue of whether to stay or leave the European Union. They were voting on a whole load of other things which reflected their actual experience of life and living where they did. They were voting on what I would say was a general feeling of bolshiness, discontent, all the stuff that we've heard, we hear practically every day about people feeling left behind. So I don't think that the question on the ballot paper was what people mostly voted on, and therefore I don't think you can limit it to people's attitudes for and against Europe. I think it went much, much broader than that. I also think that to say that it was not a revolution in the sense of overturning the existing order. And I would say also, on reflection, that I think potentially it actually has overturned the existing order. And then, of course, you have to. I would look at it in tandem with what's gone on in the United States, and I think you can see very many similarities there, and that together those things boil down to a rejection of the status quo and an attempt at least to destroy it, if not to put up anything else in its place, which is pretty much the definition of a revolution. And one of the ways I would look at it is that one of the things that's happened after Brexit, and you find in everywhere in the correspondence columns, whether it's the Independent or the Guardian or the Financial Times, which I'll take because it's led a particular correspondence on exactly this aspect. They had a selection of readers who wrote and talked about people like us. And when you look at people like us, I look at, as it were, people like me, people with a university degree, people who maybe are owner-occupiers, but they may have financial problems, but they're nothing like the financial insecurity that an awful lot of people have. It is, if you like, we can use the language of class, but it's more like the secure people against insecure people. And one of the things that I felt very strongly after the referendum was that people like us had basically lost, and we'd been rejected. Now, for the whole of my life, I cannot think of a time when a change of government in the UK actually was going to affect the fortunes of people like us particularly fiercely. Always, one way or another, our interests, the interests of the educated establishment, were going to prevail. And so you didn't really feel that you were in danger or that what you might call your values or your ambitions were going to be curtailed in any way by a change of government. Whether it was the government that you'd wanted to come in or whether it was the government you'd voted against, nonetheless, somehow you were on the side of the established order and it would basically be all right. I'm not sure that's true anymore. And I think you can compare the first referendum, if you like, to stay in the European Union with the referendum that we've just had, and you can say, well, it reflects a very similar breakdown in the composition of people who voted, but actually the result was quite different. And even though, as it were, the correlation of forces in the UK remains quite close, nonetheless, the balance has tipped, and it's tipped against people like us. And I was thinking, and I think one of the reasons I may have been invited here to talk at this session was because quite soon afterwards I wrote a column which looked at the revolutionary aspects of the Brexit vote and looked at maybe some parallels which you could see with the year of revolutions, 1917, in Russia. And one of the things that you see written about by contemporaries, by people who were reporting and writing diaries at the time of 1917, was the blissful unawareness of the people in secure establishment positions that anything was happening that was going to change their life forever. Not only that, but they were blissfully unaware, most of them, that there was another world out there, that most people did not live like they lived, and that while those people could see them, they didn't see the proletariat out there trying to storm the gates. And while you can say that things haven't been so, nothing so dramatic has happened either in Britain or the United States over the last year, I think there is still that same blissful unawareness that there are people with a very real interest in overturning the order. I think we are underestimating the forces, the non-establishment forces, whether you're looking at the United States or whether you're looking at Britain. I think the idea that Jeremy Corbyn is a lost cause is actually a little bit exaggerated, because I have nephews and nieces who have been to Corbyn rallies. The constituency that Corbyn represents is not Corbyn's demographic. It's young people who are looking at the injustices of the world and seeing Corbyn as a champion against them. So I think that if we're being a bit complacent if we say, oh, well, nothing has changed and it was really all just about Europe. I'd also, just as a final point, I'd like to say that I think, yes, you can say, well, it didn't look or feel like a revolution, and it doesn't look and feel like a revolution. But maybe by the fact that we have a universal franchise, by the fact that we have social media, by the fact that we have a parliament which is rather more difficult to storm, maybe, than either the Russian Duma or the Winter Palace, that revolutions today maybe happen in different forms. And that if this, what I would call a peaceful populist revolution, doesn't actually produce the results that the people who voted for it, the majority, if it doesn't produce the results, then we might very well have something that looks more like a very traditional revolution. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you very much. Rhiannon, what do you think?
Well, I suppose I'll start by talking about the morning of the Brexit vote. Now, I'd gone to bed about 4 a.m. I don't know how I didn't know which way it was going to swing. I didn't feel great, though. And I woke up at around dawn to the sound of a woman screaming down the street, "We're taking our country back." And that's what woke me up. And that's how I knew. And I'm sure that in the mind of that woman, Brexit was a revolution. I think to her, it felt like a revolution. And I think in the minds and the hearts of many people, it does feel like a revolution. But to borrow something that somebody said to me on Twitter earlier when I asked them what their view about it was, they said that they felt it much more resembled a populist marketing campaign than it does a revolution. And I think that was a really good way of putting it, because it played out so much in the old channels of the establishment, through the media, that I think it's very difficult to locate that sense of revolt within, I suppose, what you'd call, like, the common man, as you define populism being about the common man or woman revolting against an established elite. I think there was a sense of revolting against an established elite, but also that was led by an established elite, which is the great con about the whole thing. I also think in terms of class, it's very muddy waters, because, you can look at somewhere like Islington, which is where I woke up on the morning after the referendum, somewhere that's, often characterised as being a sort of socialist republic of, you know, very wealthy Guardian writers and politicians and kind of champagne socialists, as it were.
It's not, is it?
But it's not. No, like Islington, Islington has one of the highest child poverty rates of any borough in the country. You know, it's a very working class borough, and if you live in Islington, you're aware of that. It's why it was so bizarre when Emily Thornberry came out and, you know, did that tweet about the English flag outside the council house, and she said, oh, I've just never seen anything like that before. And she could have gone down the road to the York Way estate. They cover it in England flags every summer for the football team. You know, it's just ridiculous. Like, there's a huge sense of a working class community in Islington, and you just have to walk down Holloway Road to know that. So I think, you know, you can't just break it down to class like that, because similarly, in the part of Wales that I'm from, which is North Wales, which is predominantly Welsh-speaking and very, very working class, and, you know, contains one of the poorest council estates in the European Union. Wales is one of the poorest regions in the European Union. You know, it's been given so much EU funding, which is what was so devastating for me, was to see Wales voting for Brexit, was that we have been the beneficiaries of so much money from the European Union, particularly in the valleys. But, you know, Gwynedd, which is where I'm from, where it's majority first language Welsh, they voted to remain. So I don't think it's so simple that you can just bring it down to class. I think equally in terms of age demographics, you can't. I spoke to a lot of working class young people who were really, really upset with their working class parents who'd voted for Brexit, whilst the young working class people had voted to remain. So I think, you know, that's a really big factor, as is the idea that when people went to the polling booth, that they were voting on a single issue. I don't think they were voting on a single issue. I think it was an opportunity to kick it to the establishment. And I think the tone of the kind of political climate in Britain after the referendum, I mean, it was horrible. There was so much anger on both sides. It felt really divided. I think this wasn't just about the European Union. There were so many other factors that came into play here. I think, personally, I think it was an opportunity to make their voices known about the impacts of austerity in their communities, whether or not they knew that austerity was the culprit in their community or not. I think, you know, the knock-on effects that people were experiencing on the front line was a big factor. I think it was disaffection with the political system, not feeling like you had a voice within the political system. I remember my friend saying the same week after the vote, she was in the post office in Camden and she overheard a woman talking and she said, oh, I voted for Brexit because we're in a safe Labour seat here. And I wanted to make my dissent known. So there was kind of, you know, obviously a huge ignorance about the way that the vote operated, but I think also that desire to kind of just stick it to the kind of elites who hadn't been suffering under austerity. I think at our peril, we ignore the racism issue. I think there's a huge discomfort on the part of educated establishment people in terms of being able to acknowledge that working class communities have huge issues with racism. I personally don't have any problem saying that because I grew up in a working class Welsh village and there was huge amounts of racism and huge amounts of ignorance about immigration. And, you know, when I interviewed, because I did this big piece for The Guardian about people who were experiencing rifts in their families after the Brexit vote, and I went out and I interviewed a whole load of people who were kind of mainly young people who were finding it very difficult to kind of relate and understand why their parents or their aunts or their uncles voted this way. You know, and they were coming back and saying things like, oh, my mum voted Brexit because she says there's too many Pakistanis in her town. So, you know, it wasn't, I think it was a protest vote that wasn't even necessarily against European immigration. And that's why I think the definition of marketing campaign is a very good one, because I think what that marketing campaign that was led by members of the elite succeeded in doing was in scapegoating a group of people who largely the vote in terms of Brexit wouldn't change that demographic at all. And I think that was I think what so many of us found so horrific, all the stuff about Syrian refugees and Islamic terrorism and, you know, played a huge part in the way people voted. So I think, you know, it's important that we don't ignore that kind of racist, xenophobic aspect to it. And I think people feel a lot more comfortable saying that, you know, posh, rich people are capable of being prejudiced and capable of being ignorant and capable of being racist than they do being able to say that working class communities are.
Very good. So, James, don't you think, weren't you at least willingly concede that there was largely a big anti-establishment, anti-status quo mobilisation that went on here, that was, you know, growing income inequality, growing regional inequality, growing economic opportunities between those who have higher education and those who don't. And this then is a backlash against the elites like us. I mean, I was travelling up and down the country as part of a project for the Economic and Social Research Council. We were meant to be experts going into towns, and I remember being on a platform in Spalding in Lincolnshire, which was like a public lynching. You know, the audience was about 80% Brexit, and it was the stories you heard were, you know, a town in decline, growing competition for jobs, growing competition for public services, and how dare we come up from London and tell them that we're experts on this issue. We don't know a damn thing about what really is going on, and this is their chance to give us a kicking. And isn't that isn't this the kind of chance to give us a kicking? Isn't that a populist revolt, a rebellion, revolution in that sense?
All I can say is, if you take people with similar attitudes on those three key things that I mentioned, national sovereignty, immigration, and the economic benefits of the EU, you take people that look the same like that, and then you look at somebody who says, oh, politicians are all in it for themselves, you know, we don't trust them, and somebody else who thinks politicians are great, then there was really very little difference between those types of people in which way they voted. For me, to be anti-establishment, it must mean that people with similar policy views, some of whom are anti-establishment and some of whom are not, differ in how they voted. And that's just not true. The only way you can think of it as anti-establishment is that there were a set of policies which people didn't like, which were associated with mainstream parties. That's fine, but that's, I think, a rather different definition of what an anti-establishment vote is, to my mind. I think the other thing to say is you've got to separate out levels from differences. So, obviously, everyone's interested in the fact that the referendum went one way or the other. Fine. I guess I'm not particularly, because I'm a political scientist. I'm interested in the differences between types of people and why they voted. But they're two very different things. The level of support for the EU is determined by some things. The differences in types of people who support the EU are determined by other things. So the level of support for the EU, I mean, that goes up and down. There's been plenty of times in recent history where there's been a majority of people in Britain who wanted to leave the EU, incidentally. Last year is not some exceptional time period. Most of the time, people have been more supportive than not. But at other times, it's not. If you ask people consistently over the last 30 years a question where you could have the options of leaving, reducing the powers of the EU, and then a load of other options which are basically staying in or making it even more integrated or whatever, there is always a consistent large majority of people who want to leave or reduce the powers. So in terms of the level of support...
Not always.
Well, I mean, in almost 4 years, yeah? So in terms of level support, I mean, you know, there's a good reason why you might expect, therefore, a lot of those people who, in the past, said, oh, I want to reduce the powers of the EU, suddenly became wanting to leave, because it turns out David Cameron couldn't reduce the powers of the EU, and if there's one campaign effect that probably mattered, it was that. It was the conversion of people who wanted to reduce the powers of the EU into people that wanted to leave, because they saw that there was absolutely no prospect of reducing the powers of the EU in the near to medium to long-term future.
But the other question I wanted to ask you, James, was about age.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are, you know, the other key factor that had a really differentiating effect is age. And, you know, your explanation of it being mainly class-driven does not explain why richer, older people in Dorset, Hampshire, Sussex and Kent, and all my parents live in Shoreham-by-Sea in Sussex, and they were about the only remainers of all of their friends, and they're your classic, you know, middle-class retirees. You know, these are wealthier people on the south coast in these rural parts of the country. They were massively, the results of them individually and in those regions were very pro-Brexit. That's not explained by class.
No, absolutely not. So, I mean, I wouldn't want to say that class explains everything. I often do say that, but that's not true, yeah? There's lots of other things going on here, and one of the most important things is age. And the way that links into what I was saying earlier is it's a really good predictor of national of the strength of your national identity, particularly the strength of your Englishness in many ways. Now, why is that? I mean, there's a number of different reasons why that might be the case. It might be as people get older, they get more tied to their nation. That makes sense. It maybe it's generational. People brought up in the in the past have a stronger tie to Britishness or Englishness for whatever reason. We don't actually know. It's very, very difficult to test that. But it's definitely true that age is a good predictor of national identity, strength of national identity. Strength of national identity, unsurprisingly, relates to people's views of EU integration. So age is definitely one of the factors. I didn't mention it, I should have done, yeah.
So, Mary, to you. It was a populist revolt, yet the polls are showing that 45% of voters now saying they're going to vote Conservative. So is that really what the revolution is, that they're now going to vote Conservative as part of the revolution?
It's 40, what are the other 55% going to do?
But, so if there was this popular anti-establishment, anti-cosmopolitan, anti-elite, anti-wealthy backlash that was unleashed by Brexit, we're now in a world of politics where actually, you know, the Conservative Party that represents more traditional views and traditional values in British society is way ahead in the polls.
Yes, because what you're doing is you're using traditional categories, party political categories, that I would argue are not necessarily valid anymore. And one of the things, I mean, I think as both the other speakers pointed out, the British electoral system actually disguises that particular rift. First past the post has left, as it were, people like us and the establishment in charge since whenever. It's practically impossible to revolt against the system that way, because as you said, people are saying, well, you know, finally I can vote for something I can vote against because I've been in a safe Labour constituency since whenever. And I think one of the reasons maybe why the voting was so badly misread, not just at the expert level, but at the sort of popular level, people like me, was because we don't actually have a test of public opinion on a national scale. It's all done constituency by constituency, party by party. And so when you had a straight question which produced 52-48, the only place where you had even an inkling of that sort of ratio on those sort of questions was in the European elections, where the constituencies are much bigger and there's a proportional representation system of a sort for the voting. So, but the sort of perverse effect of that was that after the last European elections, and UKIP did so spectacularly well, generally people said, "Oh well, the European elections aren't they don't predict anything else. They're not they don't relate to anything else. The system's different, so they don't really reflect the position in the position in national politics." Well, actually, maybe it should have been the other way around. They were actually a much better predictor, a much better reflection of where opinion, how opinion divides up, than it was given credit for.
So, Rhiannon, one of the other things I find interesting about the public opinion data that James was talking about is one of the other big predictors of the way people voted were their values sets that they have. So you mentioned one of them, which was attitudes towards immigration, but one of the other values in the British election study data that's a very strong predictor is attitudes towards gender equality.
Mm.
So, I mean, have you detected any of that? Is this a backlash against feminism as a kind of mainstream view that has become part of a kind of cosmopolitan establishment, and it's just an angry white male backlash in the same way that it is with Trump, for example?
That's an interesting question. I haven't really kind of framed it in those terms before, or really heard it framed in those terms before that much. I think the kind of angry white working class man has become a kind of figurehead for these kind of revolts, if that's what you want to call them, these kinds of uprisings and these kinds of reactions, political reactions. And I suppose if you kind of look at the movements which have coincided with the rise of Trump and the success of Brexit, there has certainly been a correlation between groups with an anti-immigration stance that also deal in misogyny. I think those two things tend to go hand in hand and have done, both here and in America. I mean, you know, there's a period where I think, you know, every other week a UKIP politician was saying something awful about women. And, you know, obviously Trump's America is a whole different kettle of fish, but it's a similar thing. So I think there is that aspect, yes. But in terms of kind of the impact of austerity, that affects women disproportionately. So I think that's something to consider as well.
Was there a gender dimension to the vote, James?
Oh, it would have been tiny. I mean, yeah, traditionally it is for attitudes to the EU. I don't know exactly what it was for the referendum vote.
All right, let's open it up to questions. We've got roving mics, I think. I'll take them in batches of three. So, one in the middle here, about to throw up.
My name, David Neil Smith.
Sorry, say it again.
David Neil Smith,
David.
LSE alumni, quite a few years ago. My question is, you've touched upon it, but you haven't really said much about the impact of the referendum campaign, and that the polls were, of course, extremely close, and indeed seemed to indicate for quite a long time a defeat for Brexit, although the way you've been speaking, they seem to think, you know, going to win anyway. This raises the question whether were there any particular turning points in that referendum campaign, sort of would each panellist pinpoint whether they think there was a turning point which actually swung it for Brexit.
Turning point or impact. Over here.
Hi, my name's Nadia, and I studied at the Gender Institute, and I work there currently. So I wanted to mainly speak about your points on gender and racism in relation to Brexit. One of the things that I'd like you to talk more about is the sort of colonial identity that the UK seems to have had, and how that's been profited on essentially during the campaign for Brexit. So taking our country back, like, we know that's just totally colonialist, like, rhetoric, basically. And so I wanted us, you to think about, like, well, address a lot of things that I'm doing in terms of looking at intersectional feminism is how racist we actually are and how sexist we actually are and how deep that goes. And I wanted to ask you to look at that. And also in relation to whether or not that expression is, it's basically not populist revolution in the sense of that is actually the same views as the institutions, actually, like racism and sexism is embedded within that as well. So I would say, yeah, it's not a revolution in those terms. Thanks.
Okay, final one for this round. We'll take this chap on the corner has been waiting very... Yep.
Thank you. My name is Jan Rosenbaum. I came over from the United States to attend the conference here. And I have a comment. This morning I spent time at Whitechapel going through the survey books that the Guerrilla Girls did of art establishments, museums, and Kunsthalles in Europe to find out how sexist they were by comparison to previous studies that had been done in the United States. We've just gone through an election that pollsters did not understand. You've gone through an election, a choice that pollsters did not understand. If you look at the surveys filled out by museum directors all around Europe, and these are the brightest, most elite people that we train in our countries, the kind of hidden away unnoticed, unthought of sexism and genderism that happens in art institutions talks to me of the fact that A, people lie to pollsters, and B, people lie to themselves about what they think, and that this is it doesn't show up very much on the numbers, but it's there nonetheless.
Great. So, do people lie to pollsters? More on, is this a vote to return to our colonial roots? I can't remember who it was said. It's like Brexit's like being stuck in a lift with Jacob Rees-Mogg. I think the next line was, and it can't be fixed because the electrician is Polish. But was there a turning point in the campaign? Who wants to have a go at one of those? Mary, do you want to have a go at the campaign?
I'll have a go at the turning point in the campaign, because I actually changed my mind through the campaign as to what was going to happen. Because around February, March or so, I thought it was very likely that it could be lost in terms of the fact that the vote could go for Brexit. But by the time the vote actually happened, I didn't think that was going to happen. I thought that the Remain campaign had done just about enough to win. So I don't see a particular turning point. What I do think is that in some ways the timing of the campaign and the referendum was about as bad as it could possibly have been. Because the conjunction of the referendum campaign with the migration issue, not the European Union migration, not the Polish plumber migration, but the pictures of refugees and migrants being rescued from boats or being killed on their way or landing in Sicily, just crowds and crowds of people, and the European Union border not being able to hold them back, which led the business of taking back control, you know, those pictures were absolutely the illustration to why you could say you need to take back control, and why, although you could say, well, the East European migration was so large in part because Tony Blair declined to introduce controls for the first few years, as other Europeans did, or you can say that, well, the British market absorbed the extra labour without really any great problem, so it was all right. But when you saw pictures of the fact that the European Union border, even if Britain wasn't in Schengen, that the border was not being controlled, I think that's probably, whether it's a process or whether it's a single turning point, I think that was the issue. And I think it was just hugely unfortunate for Cameron and for the Remain campaign that those particular incidents, that particular, the refugee crisis across Europe coincided with the referendum campaign. I think if those two things hadn't happened at the same time, maybe the result would have been different.
I mean, I'll say a bit about the campaign. I thought in the campaign itself was quite interesting in that you had two Leave campaigns and one Remain campaign. And I think having two Leave campaigns really helped the Leave side, because you had an official campaign that was basically saying, take back control, but this isn't about immigration, it's about sovereignty. And then you had the real Leave.eu campaign that was all about, no, this is about getting rid of foreigners and reducing immigration. And on the other side, you have an official Remain campaign that was basically saying, well, we don't like the EU, but, you know, we think this staying in is probably better than leaving and Project Fear. But you didn't have the flip side of the equivalent of the... there wasn't a kind of cross-party campaign that could have run a pro-European type message, try and make a case that actually the EU is not such a bad thing after all. No, you know, the official Remain campaign couldn't credibly make that case because it was led by people who for 20 years have been whinging about the EU. So I think, in hindsight, having two Leave campaigns was hugely beneficial to the Leave side versus one very, very conservative, with a small c, Remain campaign that wasn't really able to make any kind of positive arguments about anything. Anyway, that's my two bits on that. Rhiannon, colonial vote for colonialism and the racist and sexist elements of this, are you rethinking your views of that or not?
No, not at all. I mean, I think colonialism was a huge part of it. I think you know, having lived in two other European countries, I think Britain does have an incredible superiority complex when it comes to Europe. I think there was a huge amount of nostalgia, a nostalgia that made me very uncomfortable for a time when Britain was a global power, aka had created that power on the backs of other people. And I think there was a huge aspect of that that was, we are now beholden to these Europeans, and who are they to be telling us what to do? We're the best. We should go back to a time when, you know, we're prosperous and powerful and we rule the waves. And, you know, even if people didn't articulate it that specifically, I think there was a desire there on the part of a lot of people. I mean, it felt at times like they just wanted to create this new kind of country that, you know, resurrected the 1950s kind of wholesale. It was bizarre, and I think that sort of ties into a whole kind of nostalgia that's been building over the last few years within the context of austerity for, you know, a kind of a sort of pre-beverage, pre-welfare state Britain. You know, it sort of manifests itself in everything from kind of Union Jack cushion covers to British bulldog paintings on the walls of pubs, and, you know, bunting and cream teas and the Great British Bake Off and street parties and a renewed fascination with the royal family, and, you know, all these things are kind of symptomatic of that. So
what do you think about rationing?
Well, you know, I'm sure there are, you know, a lot of people who kind of think it'd do us young people the world of good because we're spoiled little snowflakes. But, you know, to talk very briefly as well about kind of national identity, one of the reasons that I brought up Wales is that I think, and the reason I think that where I'm from voted for Remain is that we don't see ourselves as English. We are Welsh. We speak Welsh. We do not identify with this vision of colonial England. It's not something that means anything to us. If anything, we're more likely to identify with the countries that were occupied. And I think that's very true of first language Welsh speakers. That's how they feel. And I think that's sort of very relevant as well. There's a very interesting article on one of the LSE's blogs, Brexit blogs, actually. I can't remember who wrote it now, but it was about how Wales has actually become increasingly anglicised. 1 million English people have moved into Wales in the last 10 years, so there's been a big demographic change there. So I think that's, you know, that's something that's relevant as well. I think it's this vision of kind of colonialism and who identifies with it and who doesn't. And certainly the Welsh language-speaking population do not identify with that at all.
Mary wants to come back, but then I want to get to James to talk about polls.
I just wanted a word about colonialism and ruling the waves and all that, because I absolutely agree with Rhiannon. I'm sure that was a huge element, but I think there's another element which maybe, I don't know whether there's any sort of polling about it, but I think maybe was neglected. That I think not everybody who voted for Brexit voted for Britain to be great again. I think some people actually voted for Britain not to be part of anything greater than itself, for it actually to curl up and forget about the rest of the world, and to not to go into places like Afghanistan and Iraq, to drop its colonial pretensions, and to get used to being a small country on the edge of Europe, or, you know, a third of the way to America, or however you look at it. And I think one of the mistakes made by the Cameron-Osborne campaign was that every now and again, Osborne in particular would come out and say, look, you know, if you vote for Brexit, all sorts of dreadful things are going to happen, like Britain is not going to have the international clout that it had before, the City of London is going to go down the tubes, and house prices are going to fall. And, you know, I can imagine that there was a whole constituency out there that would say, well, hooray, you know, bring it on. And I think there was an aspect of the Brexit vote which was actually about that and was sort of the opposite of the colonial vote.
Yes. James, do you want to add to any of that, or do you want to address the poll?
No. I'll just talk about campaigns. So I think...
I'll talk about polls then.
I think we don't know much in political science, to be honest, about the way the world works, but one thing we probably do know is that campaigns don't make much difference in general. Doesn't mean all campaigns... Some campaigns can matter, but in general, campaigns make very, very little difference to the outcome. I wouldn't say that the referendum campaign last year was an exception to that rule. The polls were pretty much 50-50 for quite a long time up to the vote. There was evidently a bit of bias in them, which led everyone to believe that, in fact, the vote would go the other way, a couple of percentage points out, perhaps. But I have to say, I have a terrible record of political betting, but the day before, when you could get 9-1 on Brexit with the polls at basically, essentially 50-50, was lunacy. I ended up making quite a lot of money, which was great. But in general, the campaign didn't really seem to shift much opinion, and that's true generally of campaigns. I have to say, looking at the campaigns, I would agree with both of your assessments in that the Leave campaign was probably better. And maybe that did make it, maybe added a percentage point, or maybe even two, which was sufficient to tip the result. But, you know, it didn't have a large effect on what was
when the new immigration numbers came out, that was the only point, I think, where actually John Curtis, who was putting together the poll of polls, would track it from the start of the campaign to the end of the campaign. It was pretty much 50-50 all the way, except for a little period where Remain, I think, were starting to be 3 or 4 points ahead, and then you got the new immigration figures out that showed net 360, and then it came back to 50-50 again. So there was a point where I think Remain were winning at the beginning and Leave, but overall, on average, across the campaign, you're right. And so I remember on the night after the referendum, someone tweeted John Curtis. You know, why did the British public wants to know, why did the pollsters get it wrong? And John Curtis tweeted back, the pollsters want to ask the British public, why weren't you paying attention?
Yeah.
Because, you know, 11 of the last 23 polls had Leave ahead.
Yeah.
And 12 of the last 23 had Remain ahead. The betting markets were ignoring the polls. The financial markets were ignoring the polls. The prediction models of the guys in the city were ignoring the polls. Like, he was making money out of betting markets. I was making money doing consultancy in the city, telling them that there could be a Leave, and they were ignoring me. They were saying, by the end, oh, of course he's not going to be a Leave. Look at the betting markets. And I was like, who cares about the betting markets? Read the polls.
One interesting thing on the betting markets, which if you look at the volume, the number of bets made, then there were more bets made on Leave than there were on Remain. The reason the odds were so divergent was the amount of money that was being bet one side or the other, which, of course, I mean, without wanting to go back to this again, but it does relate to the types of people that were Remain and Leavers, because the people that thought, oh, it's definitely going to be Remain, they were surrounded by other people that they knew who thought it was going to be Remain, and who were those kind of people? They were richer people, so they bet more money.
So do people lie to pollsters? It's a difficult one. And one I think this... We have tended to underestimate support for populist right parties in opinion polls in a lot of democratic countries. And this could be that people aren't willing to tell pollsters or aren't willing to fill in online that they're going to vote for these groups, and then they do. But another explanation for that is actually whatever polling method we have, it's very difficult to reach people who don't normally vote, who are not particularly interested in politics, not wanting to talk to a pollster, not wanting to talk... You know, if a pollster phones you on the phone, they'll put the phone down. A pollster knocks on your door, you shut the door. You don't answer an email that says, join our online polling panel. And it's those people that are very, very difficult to reach by pollsters, and those people who don't normally vote, and when they do come out and vote, they actually disproportionately vote in a more populist, anti-establishment way. I mean, is that more or less... your reading of it, James?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some truth in that. I'm not sure to what extent that does apply to the referendum last year, in the sense that the polls were really just a percentage point or two out, which is well within what you might expect. But I think it certainly does apply to particularly some of the kind of what I would call not really radical right parties, but more kind of neo-fascist parties in some parts of Europe. And there is consistent underestimation of them. It's difficult to tell whether it's the sampling problem or whether it's people embarrassed. We don't know.
Right. Okay. Let's get another round. Woman, about 10 rows back.
Hi. I was just thinking that sort of a lot of the debate at the minute seems to have been about kind of you've been talking about kind of people who voted Leave as actually people who wanted to leave. But I kind of remember, I think what they call the referendum hangover of a lot of voters who actually were kind of in the middle, that they voted Leave, but they didn't actually want to leave. It was a protest vote, so to speak. And of course, my initial reaction to this was, you idiots, you can't do a protest vote for the referendum. It doesn't work that way. But I was just thinking that actually, if you think about it, like you're talking about the fact that David Cameron went to the EU to try and change the terms, and that he kind of found that... sort of the EU basically wouldn't. And I guess in their minds, maybe they were thinking, OK, we're never going to leave, but if the margins are so close, that might then kind of tip, give us a, you know, kind of a hand that we can then go to the EU and kind of possibly renegotiate our deal with it. Unfortunately, it seems like there was more voters in that kind of middle band bracket than possibly expected, and therefore we actually ended up leaving. So I guess I'm just kind of wondering, you know, kind of with the question, when it said yes and no, should there have been a third option saying maybe?
Okay. Chap right down the front here has been waiting very patiently.
In the last general election, I believe UKIP got 3.9 million votes with a net result of one MP. The current polls in France show Marine Le Pen's Front National ahead, will win the first round with no chance of ruling. Geert Wilders' Freedom Party is the first or second Holland with no chance of having any ruling input. Alternative for Deutschland, will maybe 14-15% of the vote, no chance of being part of a coalition. My question is, with this large a cohort of voters in each of the European countries, isn't the net result is that the main parties will pander to, in order to solicit their support, they'll pander to that very nationalist, populist sentiment?
The main parties will pander to the populist right, and then women over here.
I'm curious about how much might be known about the consistency or change in attitudes of the people who voted in the original referendum about whether to enter the whatever formulation it was then, was it the EC, and how they voted on the Brexit question.
I'll ask James that one, I'm not sure. Okay, who wants to have a go at that one? The regret... Was that a real thing? Mainstream parties pander?
I've got some figures on regrets, if you're interested,
And is there any consistency in terms of, or has there been a dramatic change since the 70s? James, regret.
So, yeah, very little evidence of regret, actually. So it's the standard question that's being asked to people since the referendum is, well, you know, if you had your way again, would you vote differently? These are the I imagine that someone might be interested in this, so I wrote down these figures. So 6% of people that voted Remain wish they had voted Leave. 4% of people that voted Leave wish they had voted Remain. So actually it's the opposite of the kind of story that you often hear. Very, very few people regret what they did. And if anything, it's in fact the people that voted Remain that regret their decision more than the people that voted Leave, for what it's worth.
Yes. Either of you guys want to come in on any of those ones? Will the mainstream parties pander to the populist right? What do you think?
I'd like to come in on yes, no, maybe, but on the populist right, I mean, I think that the only thing I would say to that is that I don't think it really works ever, because the populist right does it so much better than mainstream parties do when they try it. So I'm not sure that it ever really has that effect. On yes, no, maybe. What I wanted to say was that I don't think, you know, just to throw back your phrase to you, I don't think referendums work like that. but I do think there was a gigantic mistake made when the terms of the referendum were being hammered out. And that, you know, this was essentially a huge constitutional question. And the fact that there was no threshold, either for turnout, which would have been fine, in fact, but for the majority, I think was just a colossal mistake. I mean, if you have a referendum in most of Europe on a question which is essentially a constitutional question, then you have to have something like a two-thirds majority or a 10% differential in the vote for the referendum to pass. And the idea that there was no threshold, and that we are now leaving the European Union, a massive constitutional decision on the basis of 48-52, I mean, that just seems really an extraordinary mistake made in the drafting rather than in the actual conduct of the referendum.
I think also, just to make a quick point, we keep saying 48-52, we keep talking about, you know, people keep talking about the will of the people, but when you look at, you know, two-thirds of people did not vote for Brexit, one-third of people voted for Brexit, and I think that huge block of people who didn't vote is being completely ignored.
Yeah, but don't you think that, you know, I think it's a bit dangerous, particularly, look, I can be transparent, everyone knows that I teach and research EU politics, would know which way that I voted, but you know, you've got to respect the result of a referendum. The assumption is that those people who didn't vote were agnostic about the outcome, and that were happy then for the people who did
if
vote.
That to make assumption's correct, because insofar as we can contact those people with surveys, they look exactly the same as the rest of the population, if not more in favour of leaving than remaining. So if those people had voted, it would have been an even bigger margin,
but
probably.
I'm not saying that we should ignore the outcome of the referendum. What I'm saying is that it's being framed so much in the media as a majority of the population, not a majority of voters, that I think it's verging on dishonesty.
Yeah,
I think, you know, it's important that we carry on asserting the fact that that is a lie.
I think the dishonesty comes very much from the people have voted for this, and what's the opening line in the white paper from the Prime Minister saying that she now has 60 million people behind her to go for Brexit? I'm like, what? Well, that's a very weird reading of a 52-48 outcome of a referendum. Yeah, a majority voted for this, but that's not all the people of the country. On the consistency question, the data on that, it's very hard to put together. But one thing that is clear is that the vote in the 1970s was driven ideologically the other way round. So the right would, if you were on the right in British politics, you were far more in favour of us staying in the EEC. And if you were in the left, you were far more likely to be opposed. The split was down the middle of the Labour Party. And so it was something like, I think, 3/4 of Conservative voters back then voted to stay in. And a slight majority of Labour voters voted to leave, but it was much closer. Whereas this time the split was the other way around. It was 2/3 of Labour voters this time voted to remain, and a majority of Conservative voters voted to leave. So it was the right that was more anti-European this time, and the left more pro-European, and that's a complete flip to how it was in the 70s.
That's partially due, obviously, to the parties giving out different kind of cues to their voters, but it's also the composition of Labour and Conservative voters is rather different today than it was in the 1970s. Sorry to go on about class yet again, but I mean, in the 1970s, the vast majority of the Labour vote were working class voters. Today, that's not true at all. In fact, there's the percentage of people in the middle class that vote Labour at the last election was higher than the percentage of people in the working class that voted Labour.
But also it's a reflection of what Europe represents. It represented something very different in the 1970s.
Yep.
It represented it was very pitched by the left of the Labour Party as, why would you want to stay in this capitalist club that's going to deregulate the British economy? And now the EU represents, you know, we didn't roll back the state in London to have it reimposed from Brussels. So it's a kind of liberal right that's more opposed to Europe than a more, you know, it's a more kind of social democratic left that likes Europe and European regulation, environment standards and social standards. It was the flip side of that in the 1970s.
Of course, Jeremy Corbyn's never moved on since then.
All right, let's have one more round. Lots of hands now. So we'll start at the back and work down. Right at the top on the right. Maybe we'll take four now.
Can I ask the panel, and perhaps James in particular, do you think that the Brexit vote makes a united Ireland more likely? And do you think that the DUP, the governing party in Northern Ireland, will be punished at the elections for supporting a Brexit vote?
Very good question. Coming down here, I need a woman. I'm going man, woman, man, woman. Oh, well, no women have their hands up that I can see. Yes. Yes. No, longer, further along.
Hi, Good afternoon. In the rest of Europe, a lot of the referendum of votes relating to the EU have always gone pretty much 50-50 every time or close to it. And isn't the debate a little bit more global than just being the one of Europe, of democracy or the rule of a country versus the forces of the market as perceived by the average of the population?
Great. Down here. Gradually coming down. Yep.
Hi, thank you. I was just wondering, in terms of kind of situating it historically, the Brexit vote, Professor Tilley, you kind of gave an idea of the ongoing debate that's occurred over 30, 40 years, but to what extent can it be seen as a kind of delayed response to the recession that occurred in kind of 2008, 2009?
Okay, we'll take one more. Woman in the middle here.
Hi, a quick curiosity, perhaps for James. Given that he sees campaigns are largely uninfluential, the probably mostly self-attributed role of Cambridge Analytica within the campaign, how does he judge that?
Sorry, say it again.
Cambridge Analytica, Alexander Nix, supposedly this is the psychometrics.
Oh, right, yeah, okay.
Thank you.
James, why don't you answer that one first? Psychometrics.
I might answer the island question first, okay. If you don't mind, actually. It's rare that the issue of Northern Ireland is the easier one to answer, but in this case, perhaps it is. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. No one talks about, there hasn't been a lot of discussion about either what happened in the referendum in Northern Ireland, or indeed the fact there's an assembly election happening in a few weeks' time, which doesn't seem to have got any coverage at all in the mainstream British press. The DUP campaigned, which is the party in government, along with Sinn Féin until recently, campaigned to leave. Most of their voters also voted to leave. The partisan composition of Remainers and Leavers in Northern Ireland is really interesting. It's if you are Sinn Féin or SDLP, you voted to remain, for sure. If you're DUP, you voted to leave, for sure. UUP somewhere in between. So just like everything in Northern Ireland, there's a huge split down the middle, but the parties also are to some extent mobilising people. Will they be punished for that in the Assembly election? The short answer is we don't really know. The slightly longer answer, I guess, is I think it's probably going to be overshadowed by the Cash for Ash scandal, which is essentially what prompted the new Assembly election. But in reality, people that voted for the DUP are not going to go anywhere else apart from maybe the TUV or the UUP. So is it really going to change the actual makeup of the Assembly? I'd be quite doubtful. In terms of United Ireland, I would think not, but I'll bow to greater expertise on that one, I think.
I wanted to answer the Ireland question because I think the implications of the referendum result for Northern Ireland are actually, and for the UK, are actually more dangerous than they are for the Union in relation to Scotland. But the quick answer to will the vote mean a united Ireland, I would like to answer equally sort of succinctly to say, no, it won't, but it should do. Because that is the obvious solution to all the problems that the referendum's thrown up, and whether there should be a hard border, a soft border, and what you're going to do about migration across the border and all that. I think it's the obvious solution. But when I've put this to people, they said, no, it'll be war before that.
Do you want to pick any of the other ones there about the delayed response to the recession, or I can talk about the democracy versus the people or markets?
So I'll sort of combine the two, I suppose. I do think, you know, I think, yes, there is an anti-globalisation movement that is happening. Prior to the Brexit vote, there was a lot of talk about TTIP, for instance, and I think a lot of the people on the left who I know who voted Brexit did so coming from that anti-globalist stance that you were kind of talking about in the 70s, that kind of if you're on the left, you're much more likely to vote against this huge kind of federal superpower. that, you know, maybe putting business interests first. And I think certainly in Britain, I can't speak for other European countries, but, you know, those who benefited quite nicely from globalisation, thank you very much, were much more likely to vote for Remain. And I remember in the run-up to the referendum, the one piece that I read that I felt made a convincing argument for Brexit was written by Janice Turner in The Times, and it was about sort of sitting around, about her being for Brexit, basically coming from Doncaster, and about the kind of circles that she was moving in who were voting for Remain. And it is, you know, it was people who could kind of travel very freely throughout Europe and go on their holidays and have their nice houses in Tuscany and have their Polish builders come in and do their extensions. And, you know, to them, globalisation had been a very positive thing, you know, allowed their children to learn new languages and go on Erasmus and, you know, all this kind of thing. Whilst people who felt that globalisation was shafting them, for, you know, lack of a better word, were much more likely to vote for Brexit. And that sort of ties in as well with the delayed response to the recession. I think absolutely. I mean, austerity was a response to the recession, and I think, I can't not see the vote for Brexit as being a response to austerity. Our services are at breaking point, and I think immigration was a very convenient scapegoat for the fact that our services are at breaking point, not because of an influx of immigrants, but because of a lack of government investment, because of an economic policy of austerity, basically.
So I remember being in Spalding and hearing the stories about what was going on in Spalding, which was that, you know, government cuts often passed on to local government. The only asset local government has is housing, so they sell off the housing bought by private landlords. Private landlords fills it full of Polish and Lithuanian farm workers who can then live very cheaply because they're living 8 or 10 in one council house, who can then work for cash much more cheaply than the local workers can. And we're on the train on the way back, and my economist friend Jonathan Porter says, and you wonder why we have a problem. So, yeah, anyway, the question about the...
Oh, Cambridge Analytica. Yeah. I'm not exactly an expert on that. I mean, all these kind of companies and firms make great claims about how they can, you know, pin down exactly who's going to vote in what way and find out the people you need to switch. I'm sure most of it's absolute nonsense. I mean, these kind of campaign things, they're about mobilisation. They're about getting out the people you think are going to vote for you to actually turn out and vote. That's true generally of campaigns. It's not about switching people. It's not about changing people's minds, generally speaking. Was one side better at mobilising people than the other? I don't really know. But turnout was pretty high. You're not going to see turnout higher than that in Britain ever again, I would imagine. So in that sense, I don't think it made that much difference. That's, I think, slightly different to the recent US presidential election, where there were changes in turnout that did actually, I think, matter in some cases. But I think probably in the referendum it didn't make much difference.
But don't you think... But my reading of the turnout figures was the big jumps in turnout was in a lot of those safe Labour seats in the north of England, where this was clearly voters who had not voted for 3 or 4 elections and wanted to come out and vote.
So there's some truth in that, but it's actually... The differences are not that big, actually. It really was just you add 10% to turnout pretty much everywhere. I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, but you're right. More working class constituencies, more Labour constituencies, just tiny increases. But once you...
So there were some anecdotes like Sunderland, I think it was 20% higher in Sunderland.
Sure. I mean, I can come up... I can't. But in principle, I could come up with constituencies where there's big change in turnout. But yep. On average, it didn't seem to make a big difference.
OK. We'll come to one more round again. This guy on the end here has been waiting very patiently.
Is it working?
Yep.
Yeah. The new currency is not money, but knowledge. And the professionals of which some of the panel were speaking have that knowledge and aren't you ignoring that those are the new elites, and that's what the populist vote is against?
Thank you very much. You're standing right next to somebody there at the back with a hand up. Hi.
Hi. Laurie Earlham, a former student of Simon's.
Laurie.
Hey. Just one area that I wanted you guys to expand on a bit was the role of the media and, you know, how impactful that actually was or not. If you speak to the people who were working for the Remain campaign and running it, they, you know, their gripe was that they weren't getting the airtime that the two Leave campaigns were getting. And also, it seems to me that both the US election and Brexit has been quite a sort of comeback moment for the Murdoch family in quite a significant way.
Okay. There's a woman here down three rows back.
Hi. So you were talking about a little about inequality and about UKIP gaining power among traditionally Labour voters. And I wanted to ask if you think that the Remain campaign suffered from the Labour support of neoliberalism and global free market agendas in the last couple of decades, if there is a process going on there that...
Failure of, okay, let's do those three. There's some quite meaty ones there. The media, it's a backlash, backlash against us, people like us. We are the knowledge purveyors. We're also probably in the media as well. And Labour embracing neoliberalism and hence losing its traditional working class voters. Who wants to have a go at any of those?
I'll talk a bit about the media because I think it is something that's been really understated. In the course of this debate, but sort of in the context of the larger debate as well. I think partly because people are squeamish about implying that certain groups of people lack the analytical skills to realise when they're being lied to. And I think that is a major factor. And I think if you look at some of the things that was said in the tabloids, and you're right, it is the revenge of the tabloids. The tabloids are back in a way that we haven't seen them, you know, with this much power in a very, very long time. I mean, you know, the left-wing press has been almost completely decimated in this country. We've barely got any left-wing...
You're in the media. Why are the tabloids so powerful now? No, the readership of them has collapsed. They're nowhere near as you can understand perhaps in the 80s where, you know, the readership of The Sun was, what, 3 or 4 million? It's down to peanuts now. And nobody really, in terms of numerically, nobody really reads The Mail or The Sun or The Express relative to 10 times as many who were reading them 20 years ago. So why are they so powerful? I'm not in the media, but...
I think because the establishment still regards them as... regards the news media as being the kind of... medium for kind of expressing the status quo, and I think that's the thing. I think baby boomers is the answer to your question. Baby boomers buy newspapers. Baby boomers are powerful. You know, one of the girls I interviewed about the Brexit kind of rifts in her family said, you know, I don't wish to sound patronising, but I think young people, part of the reason that young people voted for Remain is because I think they have much better bullshit detectors than older people do, because we grew up on the internet. We're used to being confronted with false information all the time. We've got very finely tuned analytical skills in terms of analysing the media that we're presented with and working out what's fake and what's not fake, what's false, what's skewed. You know, we have access to social media where, you know, bubbles, social media bubbles notwithstanding, there is constant debate and constant kind of nitpicking about facts and about statistics and about polls. So I think that's a major factor in it as well. I think Murdoch and Rothermere and, you know, various other Desmond are forwarding their own interests in, you know, Rothermere's a non-dom in their encouragement of the Brexit vote. And I think you know, you can say that campaigns don't make a difference, but you have to remember that campaigns kind of... You have campaigns and then you have sort of simmering campaigns that have a cumulative effect over many, many years. You have a drip feed of anti-immigrant sentiment that kind of goes back for decades and decades and kind of builds. And, you know, to go back to the question about a turning point, I think, you know, the context of global terrorism is something that really, you know, was grasped on by the tabloids as something that Brexit could protect the British people from. And it goes back to what Mary was saying about people wanting to curl up. And I do think fear was a big factor there. And I think what the tabloids did so brilliantly and why they're thriving now is that they were so amazingly successful at stoking fear and making people feel vulnerable. So that would be my answer.
Mary, you wanted to come in on the media question.
Yes, I want. It's very dangerous to ask a media question when you've got media people on the panel, because we can run the whole of the rest of it on that subject. I actually disagree with Rhiannon substantially, because I don't think that the press has anything like the power that people ascribe to it. And I think it's been very convenient, especially for Remain and especially for the sort of disappointed establishment, to say, oh, it was all about the Daily Mail, it was all the Sun, it was all these dreadful headlines. I actually don't think that's true. I think that the press, generally out of the media, reflect back to people what they already think. And I don't think it would have had the slightest effect on the vote whatsoever. So I think that I think the power to influence of the press, including the tabloid press, is actually hugely exaggerated.
But what about, I mean, the comment that was from Laurie was about, you know, for example, the BBC, was there any sense that, I was kind of, we as meant to be experts to be used by the BBC, they dropped us after a couple of weeks because they said, well, Gove says we don't like experts, so we're not allowed to talk to experts, because if we talk to experts, they're going to tell us we're being pro-Remain. So, and the BBC tried to do the kind of on the one hand, on the other hand. On the one hand, there's 90% of economists think Brexit's going to be bad. On the other hand, we found some economist under a stone somewhere who's going to tell us that...
Although, to be fair, Simon, many of those economists turned out to be completely wrong, didn't they?
Yes,
they
that's
predicted
true.
Economic collapse immediately after the vote, which didn't happen.
Well, not all of them. There were some who did. There were others who were saying medium term.
Let's say 90% of the 90% yes. said that. So, I mean, anyway, that's neither here nor there. Just on the media point, I mean, I think that's completely right. The media doesn't persuade people. It reinforces their pre-existing opinions. That's the broad consensus in the academic literature, at least. And I think, you know, very few people these days read a tabloid newspaper, read a newspaper full stop. I don't see that really having a massive impact on people's views.
But James, I think it's right that the evidence shows that the media doesn't persuade people to change their minds about voting. Well, there is some evidence in the US under certain contexts, that with the Fox News effect. But there is evidence, I think, that the media successfully manages to raise issues, though.
Well, I don't know. I mean, one of my PhD students is looking at media coverage in Britain of immigration and how that relates to public opinion about immigration, salience of it. And he's not finished his PhD, but it looks like what's happening is public opinion changes in reaction to levels of immigration, which makes sense, and then the media reflects that increased salience to people. And I mean, that for me makes sense as well, just looking more anecdotally at what's going on. There we go.
But, I mean, you know, without wanting to kind of be overly personal, how many Brexit voters have you sat in a room with, and have you experienced, as I have, for example, people quoting the tabloids verbatim as fact that they've read? I mean, that to me is, you know, a powerful argument for how the tabloids do influence people. Similarly, people posting things on social media and people kind of believing everything that they read. I mean, if you've sat in a room with someone where they've basically said that they believe everything in the Daily Mail to be true, and they've said that to you, and they've referenced articles, and they've referenced kind of bogus statistics, I don't see how you could say that the tabloids aren't having an impact.
So people like to justify their opinion, yeah? Exactly. So to justify your opinion, you rely on some kind of expert source, and some people might regard a newspaper as an expert source.
The only reason you've gone out and bought the Daily Mail is because you think that that's where you're going to find your review, your views reinforced. So I think that it's...
Okay, we've got two other questions we've got to get through. One was about the... Was this a backlash against knowledge, the kind of, you know, we have Gove, highly educated himself, saying that, you know, we're all sick of experts, and we are sick, is the country sick of experts?
I'm sick of experts, no. I think, is the country sick of experts? Probably yes, but I think that's a great shame. But yeah, I do think they're sick of experts. I think the whole Brexit thing was that people were sick of being told what to think, and they were sick of feeling as though there was kind of an elite lording.
Hence the 90% of economists telling them not to vote for Leave.
Yeah.
On the inequality in traditional Labour voters, is it the fact that Labour has embraced capitalism, embraced globalisation and neoliberalism? Is that the reason why they've lost their working class voters? What's your sense, James?
I wouldn't perhaps talk about embracing neoliberalism, but yeah, basically, I mean, if you look at what happened in the 1990s, Labour attracted a load of middle class voters and repelled a load of working class voters that they used to have. And those working class voters, some of them went to UKIP, but most of them actually just stopped voting.
Yeah.
So previously in Britain, you had almost no differences between the social classes in turnout rates. Today, massive differences. And that's entirely due to effectively what Labour chose to do. It was a sensible thing for them to do at the time because they thought they could grab hold of these middle class voters and hold on to some of those working class voters. Turned out they weren't so successful at holding on to the working class voters, and now they've ended up with a kind of rather narrow segment of the middle class that supports the Labour Party. I think the other thing just to say on UKIP support or radical right party support generally in other European countries, I think it's very tempting to say that these are voters that used to vote for left-wing parties. And to some extent that's true, but it's a real mixture of people. It's true that those people tend to be more working class than other party supporters, but that doesn't mean they necessarily used to vote for the left-wing party. There's plenty of people that used to vote for the Conservatives who had working class jobs in the... You know, they had to. How did the Conservatives win all those elections when two-thirds of the population was working class? So it's not that UKIP supporters are necessarily former Labour supporters. Some of them are, but they actually came from lots of other places. Indeed, there's a sizable segment of UKIP support that used to vote for the Lib Dems, which might be surprising, but it shouldn't be, because the people that voted for Lib Dems were just voting for a party that isn't one of the two main parties. That's where their support always used to come from, and then they went into government and that all disappeared.
Well, we have to wrap it up there. Thank you very much, Mary.